Imagine working for decades in an incredibly high-stress job. I mean, you put in the brutal hours, you miss the holidays, you're working these overnight shifts.
Yeah, missing out on real life.
Right. And over all those years, you accumulate a very specific set of financial assets, like earned vacation time, terminal leave, retirement supplements.
All the stuff you rely on.
Exactly. You build your entire financial transition to retirement around this money. You plan your taxes around it. And then on your very last day, you go to collect what you've rightfully earned, and you find out it's all been completely frozen.
Just gone. I mean, theoretically.
Right. And why?
Mm-hmm.
Because of an unproven, entirely unresolved administrative complaint.
It's a staggering scenario for anyone to find themselves in, honestly. You know, you were expecting this clean break, a transition into the next phase of your life, and instead you hit a bureaucratic wall. It completely upends your financial stability.
Totally.
Yeah.
And whether you're, you know, fascinated by the nitty-gritty of administrative law or you're just fiercely protective of earned compensation, this deep dive is absolutely for you.
Oh, yeah.
Today, we are analyzing this incredibly extensive legal breakdown by Eric Sanders of the Sanders Firm PC. The paper is titled, "The NYPD Illegally Created Its Own Retirement Forfeiture System."
And this source material, it's incredibly dense, highly detailed. But it raises some really profound questions about the limits of government power. We are going to impartially explore the legal arguments laid out in this analysis to see, you know, exactly how this system operates.
Yeah, that is the mission for today. We're going to map out the actual legal boundaries of a police commissioner's disciplinary power, analyze the due process risks when pending allegations function as permanent economic leads.
Which is a huge issue.
Oh, massive.
Yeah.
We'll also uncover the financial hardship this creates and look at a proposed legislative framework that the author says could, you know, finally fix this structure.
To really understand the gravity of the source's argument, though, we first have to establish what the law actually allows a department to do.
Right.
We need to look closely at the boundary between an accusation and a conviction.
Okay, let's unpack this, because the source points us straight to New York City Administrative Code, Section 14.115.
Mm-hmm.
Now, looking at this code, it is essentially the foundational rulebook for police discipline.
Right. And what's fascinating here is that the author emphasizes that Section 14.115 does give the police commissioner broad disciplinary authority.
Okay.
So the paper isn't arguing that the commissioner lacks power. The statute explicitly authorizes reprimands, suspension without pay, dismissal, and even a salary forfeiture up to 30 days.
But there's a catch, right?
Exactly. That punishment requires what the law calls an adjudicative predicate.
Meaning like a formal conviction.
Yes, a conviction by the commissioner, a court, or another officer of competent jurisdiction. You know, the statutory structure dictates a very specific sequence. First, the government investigates and brings charges. Then, an authorized formal process determines if the misconduct actually happened. Only after that determination does the commissioner exercise that broad discretion to punish.
So wait, they are essentially skipping step two entirely.
That's the argument.
The department is taking an unresolved open case, like maybe an internal affairs investigation that hasn't even concluded, and they're treating it like a final forfeiture judgment. I mean, it's like your bank freezing your entire life savings just because someone threatened to sue you long before a judge even looks at the case.
That's a great way to put it. The source argues this completely disrupts the legal sequence. An open investigation is just an investigative process. It's a search for facts. It is not an adjudication.
Right. It's not a verdict.
Exactly. So when the department uses an open case to impose an immediate economic disability like freezing your terminal leave or your accumulated vacation, they're imposing the consequence of discipline before the misconduct has actually been established.
I want to pause here really quickly because we are throwing around terms like terminal leave, and it's important to define what we are actually talking about for you listening. Terminal leave usually means using up your bank's sick or vacation time to stop working early while technically remaining on the payroll until your official retirement date.
Which is a huge financial bridge for a lot of people.
Right. And the paper also mentions the Variable Supplements Fund, or VSS, which is a specific statutory pension supplement for certain officers, plus, you know, just accrued vacation time.
And the author makes a really crucial point of breaking down these different types of money because they aren't all legally identical.
Right.
Terminal leave, VSF payments, accrued vacation, they all arise from totally different statutory, contractual, or collective bargaining frameworks.
Which means the department can't just use a generalized pending charges excuse to seize all of it in one swoop. You can't just group vastly different contractual benefits into one big pile and say, well, we have an open case, so we're keeping all of this.
Yeah. No, you really can't. Each of those benefits requires its own specific source of legal authority to be withheld. The source argues that the commissioner's broad disciplinary power under Section 14.115 can't just, you know, silently migrate from one legal regime to another without a legal bridge.
Right. They have the power to discipline, but...
But they do not have inherent, generalized executive forfeiture jurisdiction over every single asset a member has when they leave service. Executive power cannot simply be expanded by renaming a penalty a hold or a pending clearance.
Right. Just changing the label doesn't change the law.
Exactly. Nomenclature doesn't change reality. Mm. Legal authority has to bridge the gap between an allegation and a financial deprivation.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though, because I want to push back on this a bit, kind of playing devil's advocate based on what we are reading.
Sure, go for it.
Let's say an officer does something genuinely awful on day 19,999 of a 20-year career. Isn't the department just trying to hold potentially bad actors accountable before they ride off into the sunset with a golden parachute? I mean, why is freezing the money so legally dangerous?
It's a fair question, and the paper actually addresses that exact line of thinking impartially. It acknowledges that the NYPD, or, you know, any public agency, has a perfectly legitimate interest in maintaining discipline and holding employees accountable.
Okay.
The issue isn't whether they should want accountability. The issue is the lack of substantive legal authority to seize property without due process. The seriousness of an accusation doesn't magically create the legal authority to restrain an economic interest.
Right, because if you allow an accusation to equal a conviction just for the sake of administrative convenience, you fundamentally bypass the whole concept of due process.
Exactly.
You are letting the government punish someone who, under the eyes of the law, is entirely innocent at that moment.
And think about the practical reality the text describes. You have a retiree actively restructuring their household finances.
Yeah.
They are transitioning from a regular active duty salary to pension income, which takes time to process. They might have substantial tax obligations coming due. They need that terminal leave and accrued vacation right then and there to bridge the gap. By freezing those funds indefinitely, the government is inflicting a massive economic injury on an individual who has, at that point, only been accused.
The ultimate insight here, to me, is that time itself is property. If the government steals 2 years of your access to your money, they have stolen something from you, even if they eventually return the exact dollar amount.
That is such an important point.
You know, you've lost the investment potential, you've lost the ability to pay down interest-bearing debt, and you might have racked up massive legal fees just trying to get it back.
And that leads to what the author considers the most troubling feature of this whole system, the coercive leverage. The department exercises near total control over the pace of the administrative investigation. They decide when to pursue leads, when to bring formal charges, and when a file is considered, you know, complete.
So they are essentially weaponizing the calendar against their own employees. If they control the clock, and the clock determines when your money is released, the unresolved allegation functions as a permanent economic lead.
Yeah. The source argues this creates a circular mechanism of power. The agency's own failure to reach a final determination becomes the very mechanism through which the agency preserves its leverage.
Wow.
In conventional legal settings, a lien requires a recognized source of authority, like a statute, a contract, or a court order. Here, the bare allegation itself is used to encumber the property indefinitely.
Let's play out the psychology of that for a second. You are sitting there, unable to access your life savings because of an open case. You can't pay your mortgage.
The stress would be unbelievable.
Right. You're forced into a corner where you might accept a disciplinary settlement that you otherwise would have fiercely fought. You end up surrendering your earned property just to get the rest of your money released so your family can survive.
And the author draws a sharp, vital distinction here. There is a vast legal difference between negotiating a forfeiture voluntarily as part of a settlement agreement and having your property restrained without legal authority first, only to have that deprivation used as leverage to force you into a settlement.
Oh, definitely.
One is a negotiated consequence. The other risks turning the employee's own compensation into security for the government's unproved case.
Okay, but if this practice is so blatantly outside the bounds of the statutory law, my immediate question is, why hasn't a judge struck it down? Like, why hasn't a union sued to stop it and dismantle the entire framework?
Well, the paper dives deep into the illusion of a remedy, primarily focusing on something called an Article 78 proceeding.
Okay, Article 78.
Yeah. In New York, an Article 78 proceeding is the standard legal mechanism for judicial review of governmental action. It's how a citizen challenges an agency decision that they believe is arbitrary, capricious, or unlawful.
Wait, hold on. Before we go further, What exactly does an Article 78 proceeding look like in practice? Like, for a retiree trying to get their money back?
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it's an incredibly burdensome post-deprivation proceeding. The burden is shifted entirely onto the retiree.
Okay.
The government takes the money immediately, without a hearing. The retiree then has to hire legal counsel, prepare an administrative record, file a lawsuit in state court, and argue that the agency acted without authority.
That's insane.
Yeah.
You're basically forced to spend your own diminished retirement money on lawyers just to prove the government didn't have the right to take your money in the first place.
Exactly.
Even if the court ultimately agrees with you, you've already borne the financial burden of testing whether the executive branch had lawful authority.
And the author notes that because this is litigated on a fragmented case-by-case basis, the systemic lack of authority is never permanently struck down.
I see.
Yeah. One retiree might fight, spend the money on lawyers, and get a judge to order their specific funds released. But the department can just turn around the next day and apply the exact same unwritten policy to the next retiree.
So they just absorb the occasional loss as, like, the cost of doing business.
Precisely. Courts can inadvertently normalize this extra statutory practice when they resolve these disputes too narrowly.
Right. They miss the forest for the trees.
Exactly. A court might say, in this specific instance, the department failed to follow procedure, give this officer their money back. But that narrow ruling doesn't answer the foundational structural question. Does the department have the lawful power to do this at all?
The paper calls this an ultra vires inquiry, right?
Yeah.
Asking whether the agency possessed the power to begin with.
Yes.
But because of how fragmented the lawsuits are, the practice survives simply because the transaction costs of challenging it exceed the value of the claims. Like, if they're holding $5,000 of your vacation time, it is going to cost you way more than $5,000 in lawyer fees to fight it. So you just walk away.
Which creates an environment ripe for civil rights violations. The paper identifies a severe blind spot here. Whenever you have an undefined discretionary forfeiture system without transparent standards, it naturally invites discrimination and retaliation.
Oh, yeah.
The author outlines massive exposure under Title VII, the New York State Human Rights Law, and federal statutes like 42 U.S.C. Section 1983.
Unpack that mechanism for me. How exactly does an administrative delay translate into a civil rights violation?
Well, if an agency has a vague, unwritten rule for freezing assets, human bias naturally creeps in.
Right.
The discretionary space allows administrators to fast-track the paperwork for their friends and slow-walk the investigations for people they don't like.
Ah, the classic double standard.
Exactly. And the text points out that under Supreme Court precedent, specifically a case called Muldrow v. City of St. Louis, you don't even have to prove a significant or material degree of employment harm under Title VII.
Really?
Yeah. If a race or sex-based decision affects your accrued compensation in any way, it is actionable.
And the paper also highlights Robinson v. Shell Oil Co., which established that Title VII's anti-retaliation protections extend to former employees.
Right.
So the fact that the economic consequence happens after your final tour of duty doesn't sever the employer's action from your federally protected rights.
The source argues that the administration of the predicate, the open case itself, can be highly discriminatory. If officials selectively decide which investigations get resources, which cases get administratively closed in 3 days, and which ones stay open for 3 years,
then discrimination occurs long before anyone formally decides to withhold a dollar.
Exactly.
So if favored officers get their open cases magically expedited and their money released on day one, while minority officers or whistleblowers face indefinite holds for the exact same types of administrative complaints, that is textbook actionable retaliation.
Yes.
The administrative label of an open case is basically just a smokescreen.
And that's where Section 1983 comes into play, because the NYPD is a governmental actor. The text notes this can lead to individual constitutional accountability for the specific supervisors who manipulate key statuses.
Right.
But to get municipal liability, to sue the whole city for damages, you have to prove an official policy or custom under what is known as the Monell Doctrine.
Okay, I've seen that term pop up in civil rights cases before.
Yeah.
Under the Monell Doctrine, you can't just sue a city because one of its employees went rogue.
Right.
You actually have to prove the city itself had an official policy or a widespread established custom of doing this that acted as the moving force behind the constitutional violation.
And the author suggests that a decades-long practice of indefinitely freezing retirement funds based on unwritten rules might just qualify as that widespread custom.
Wow.
The civil rights implications also extend heavily to the police unions. The author is very clear that the unions cannot treat this as just a standard management problem.
Yeah, the paper actually puts the unions on serious notice. It explains that police unions can face liability under the duty of fair representation, the DFR.
The DFR.
Which essentially means that because a union has the exclusive right to represent the employees, they have a legal obligation to represent all of them fairly, in good faith, and without discrimination.
If a union selectively helps some members fight these holds but ignores others, they are in legal jeopardy. The text points out that if union officials know the department lacks a statutory basis for withholding this money, but they systematically refuse to test the issue in court.
Well, maybe quietly getting exceptions for their favored members.
Exactly. That arbitrary conduct breaches the DFR.
And if the union actually coordinates with the department on whose benefits stay withheld and whose get released, they could face independent liability under federal and state anti-discrimination laws. I mean, Title VII explicitly prohibits labor organizations from causing an employer to discriminate.
The paper even notes that under certain circumstances, if a union willfully participates in joint activity with the state to accomplish a constitutional deprivation, they might face Section 1983 liability themselves.
It's massive.
The core argument is that union silence here is not just a disappointment in labor relations. It is potentially part of the legal problem.
So what does this all mean? How do we fix a system that is operating entirely on custom rather than law? We've seen that piecemeal Article 78 lawsuits aren't working because of the burden they place on the retiree.
Right.
Union grievances are allegedly falling short. The author argues that we need a structural solution, specifically statewide legislation.
This raises an important question about how to codify fairness while still allowing a police department to legitimately investigate misconduct.
Right, finding that balance.
Exactly. So the paper proposes a very specific 5-point legislative blueprint. First and foremost, the text calls for a clear statutory rule prohibiting public employers from withholding earned retirement-related compensation solely because of unresolved allegations.
Meaning a law that simply says an accusation on its own is not a legal reason to take someone's money.
Yes.
If the government wants to restrain an economic interest, they have to point to a specific statute, a specific contract clause, or an adjudicative order that actually permits it.
The second part of the blueprint allows for narrowly authorized temporary holds, but with strict unyielding deadlines.
Okay.
The source recognizes that the government might have a legitimate interest in preserving funds during a pending proceeding, but that power must have objective limits. If the legislature authorizes a hold, the expiration date must be fixed by law.
So no more indefinite holding patterns, where the agency just runs out the clock to force a settlement. If the employer wants to keep holding the money past that statutory deadline, they would have to go to a neutral tribunal, make an evidentiary showing, and actually prove why keeping the money frozen is legally necessary.
Exactly. Third, the blueprint demands mandatory substantive written notice. You can't just verbally tell a retiree their money is held because their case is open.
Right. None of this backroom stuff.
The notice has to identify exactly what money is being held, the precise legal authority the department is relying on, the maximum period authorized, and how the retiree can challenge it.
Which fundamentally flips the burden. The retiree wouldn't have to hire a private lawyer and file a lawsuit just to find out what legal authority the government claims to be using.
The fourth pillar addresses meaningful remedies, mandatory interest on wrongfully withheld amounts, and fee shifting.
Let's talk about why fee shifting is the engine that makes this work. Fee shifting means that if you sue the government for violating your rights and you win, the government has to pay your attorney's fees.
Right.
If they unlawfully hold $2,000 of your vacation pay, you can't afford to pay a lawyer $10,000 to fight it. Fee shifting makes it economically viable to challenge even small, unlawful deprivations because lawyers know they will get paid by the state if they prove the agency broke the law.
And the mandatory interest fixes the temporal value of money issue we discussed earlier.
Right.
If they hold your money for 2 years and then return the principal, the interest makes the retiree whole for the time they lost. Finally, the fifth point is transparency. The paper calls for requirements to aggregate demographic data on these holds. Public employers would have to report how many retirement restraints they impose, the value of the benefits affected, the legal basis, and the duration.
And why aggregate the data? Because you need to expose the bias. That data allows oversight bodies and courts to identify patterns.
Yeah.
If certain protected groups or known whistleblowers are experiencing much higher rates of having their money withheld, the transparency data brings that out of the shadows.
Yeah.
It ensures that the discretionary space isn't being used for selective enforcement.
The author suggests this shouldn't just be a New York City law, but statewide legislation. Any public employer, sheriff's offices, fire departments, massive state agencies that controls internal investigations and separation processing could theoretically reproduce this exact same coercive mechanism.
Wow.
You can give law enforcement executives extensive disciplinary authority while still defining the procedures and sanctions strictly through law.
You cannot have an undefined space where economic rights are withheld based on unwritten customs, which really brings us to the core summary of this entire analysis. An accusation is not a conviction.
Simply put, yes.
The text argues forcefully that government agencies cannot bypass the legal boundaries of their disciplinary power by silently transforming unresolved allegations into financial lay-ins against a worker's career earnings.
The paper's thesis is clear. Government must act within the jurisdiction granted to it by law. When it moves outside that defined structure, it risks violating constitutional due process, civil rights statutes, and the fundamental principles of administrative law.
It is a massive legal blind spot, and it leaves us with a final provocative thought to mull over for you listening. If a massive governmental agency can successfully create a multi-million dollar forfeiture system simply through unwritten administrative custom and strategic delay, completely sidestepping statutory boundaries, what other hidden bureaucratic levers are silently encumbering the rights of public employees right now, completely out of the public eye?
It certainly makes you wonder how much of what we accept as standard administrative procedure is actually resting on a solid legal foundation, and how much is just institutional momentum that no one has had the resources to challenge.
We started by imagining your bank freezing your life savings based on a mere threat of a lawsuit. The analysis we've explored today suggests that for some retirees, that isn't a hypothetical scenario. It is their daily reality. Until the legal gap between an accusation and a conviction is respected, that freeze remains a chilling reminder of unchecked administrative power.